The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the last program of the week. Hard to believe. Friday is already upon us. Of course, this weekend, as we've been saying the last few days, we've got the big campaign scheduled for Red Deer, Canada, Sunday night and Monday night, and then Tuesday night in Spokane. So look forward to some updates while we're on the road over the next few days. Coming up on today's program, We'll update you on our producer from Edstone, Sam. He's actually here in the studio this morning. He's in America for a little bit longer, and we'll update you on his family situation. I know many of you have been asking him, and he, as he said last night, hasn't been able to answer all of his emails. So we'll give you a few details on that here in just a moment. And also, we've been compiling some information on really some heart-wrenching stories coming from abortion survivors. This is a subject, abortion that is, that's been in the news quite a lot this year. As you have some states, some very dark blue states that have been working in recent months to liberalize abortion laws. And then you have other states, red states, that have been working in the opposite direction. And again, yet another hot button issue that's causing lots and lots of division. So we'll come to that in just a bit as well. First, though, the headlines, of course, since yesterday on through to today, the Iranians shooting down this U.S. drone. A $220 million drone. This is not a small aircraft by any means, as you might have heard there at the top of the hour. The New York Times is claiming that Mr. Trump, President Trump, ordered an attack and then changed his mind. So you can take that report, I guess, with a grain of salt. Victor Davis Hanson has a pretty good piece, I think, on how the U.S. is still in a pretty good position, and that this is most likely a desperate act on the part of Iran, which really is being hit hard by the sanctions. At the same time, though, as Victor Davis Hanson brings out, President Trump really does have to walk carefully as he campaigned on pulling out of these unnecessary wars in the Middle East, and yet he doesn't want to go to the other extreme either and appear to be weak. Richard told me this morning that Brett Stevens, just to look back on a little bit of fairly recent history, he had a column last week about when a U.S. ship, this was back during the 1980s, when during the Iran-Iraq war, when a U.S. ship hit an Iranian-laid mine, President Reagan, at the time, he pretty much sunk half the Iranian Navy. So I think this was maybe one of the biggest naval battles since World War II. And of course, you didn't hear much from Iran after that. We're hearing a lot from Iran today. It'll be interesting to see what kind of response there will be, if any, because if there's no response, you can expect a lot more belligerence on the part of the King of the South. Of course, ultimately, we know that the coming clash is actually between Iran and the King of the North, which, of course, is the European beast power. So our update from our producer, Sam Livingston, his wife, of course, was pregnant earlier this year. She experienced some bleeding, so a few complications with the pregnancy. And then there was some travel during the summer to come over to the States for a wedding. And it was after that they arrived here that her water broke. And this was back in mid-May. So it started to drain slowly. She went to the hospital to have it checked out, and I think was in there for about 3 weeks before the baby was delivered prematurely at about 30 weeks. So little Daniel is doing just fine. He's in the hospital still. Brooke was released, I think, last week. But he was born at 2 pounds, 5 ounces. So just a tiny, tiny little boy. But he's been, as Sam has said, he's been packing on some weight in recent days. And for all that we know, he appears to be very healthy and will probably be released from the intensive care unit in a few weeks' time. So Sam's doing well, his wife is doing well, and the little boy, miraculously, is doing well. So that's really good news, and I'm sure Sam is happy for all of you to know that they're doing well and that he very much appreciates your outpouring of response. One of the things that we've discussed through this difficult trial for them is just the intense efforts to try to preserve this little life that was growing inside of Brooke. And even after its birth, at just 30 weeks, a tiny little boy, as I said, and yet to think that there's this push, this radical push to try to kill little babies that same size, 28 weeks in, 30 weeks in. Who can forget what the governor of Virginia said earlier this year when he talked about possibly even killing the baby even after the birth? Here's what Governor Northam said back in January, clip one.
If a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mothers.
A discussion between the physician and the mothers as to whether they would keep the baby alive or kill the baby. Infanticide, in other words. That's what's up for discussion in some of these dark blue states, as I said. There's an estimated 40 to 50 million abortions happening every year worldwide. That's according to the World Health Organization. That's about 125,000 abortions per day. There's actually a website, Worldometers. info/abortions, you can go and get the running count, almost like the U.S. debt clock, of abortions every day. As of this morning, it's at 19,900,000 for the year. In the U.S., here in the U.S., it's at 800,000 abortions per year. Going back a couple of years ago, or a few years ago, 2015, almost 20% of U.S. pregnancies ended in abortion. So 1 in 5 pregnancies. And what a contrast. On the one hand, like I just explained to you, you have young couples or a family that's doing everything it can to have a healthy delivery, to preserve that life, and then others who would just snuff it out early on in the pregnancy, maybe even late in the pregnancy. And really, a little told story in all of this is the story that comes from individuals who survive abortions. An abortion procedure doesn't always result in a dead baby. Sometimes the babies don't die in the womb. It's rare, and as I say, the story is not often told, but it does happen. Now, most of these abortion survivors only live for a few minutes or maybe for a few hours, especially if they don't get medical care. But in some few cases, these unwanted infants are given medical care, and then they survive even into adulthood. And what a story they have to tell. They're a living testament to the fact that a fetus aborted at any time in the pregnancy, it's not just a lump of cells. It's a living human being. That's what it is. It's a life. Earlier this year, you might remember some of the news regarding the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. All of these prominent Democrats running for president, they voted against it. What was this legislation about? Well, this would have, according to news piece here, this would have required that any healthcare practitioner present at the time of a birth exercise the same degree of professional skill, care, and diligence to preserve the life and the health of the child as a reasonably diligent and conscientious healthcare practitioner would render to any other child born alive at the same gestational age. In other words, if there's complications during the abortion procedure and that little baby comes out alive, then you should do everything that you can to preserve and protect that life. That bill was struck down by Democrats mostly. They didn't want to see that happen. It says here, the bill which exempted the mother involved in the birth from prosecution also would have required practitioners to ensure that the child born alive is immediately transported and admitted to a hospital. Well, you would just care for it because that's what you do. Because it's a human life. Another article here. This is from the Heritage Foundation back in February. It says, it's hard to believe anyone would oppose such a policy. But a lot of people did. People running for president oppose this. Don't try to spare that life. Don't try to protect that life. Certainly don't try to extend that life, because the mother didn't want it, and it's her choice. So even if it comes out alive, you let it die. You kill it. It's hard to believe anyone would oppose such a policy. Yet well-funded abortion advocates like Planned Parenthood and the National Abortion Federation, who are radically out of step with the national consensus, have convinced some in Congress that requiring medical care for babies who survive abortion is an assault on reproductive health care. Can you believe this? Others object by saying this is a hypothetical problem, that infants don't really survive abortions. But the data show they are wrong. Others say it's a hypothetical and it never really happens. It does happen. There are survivors. And those survivors have a chilling story to tell. A heart-wrenching story. It says here, between 2003 and 2014, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recorded 143 cases of infants surviving abortion and acknowledged that the total number was likely underestimated. A lot of hospitals don't report these figures. But there are cases. There are survivors. And you can see why the data is limited, because there's a lot of people that don't want this revealed. They don't want these stats, these facts revealed. They want to go on pretending that it never does happen, and so we shouldn't be concerned about it. And we certainly don't need legislation that compels these doctors to try to save that life. If it comes out alive, save it. Use medical care to extend that life. All these pro-life, you can look at the other side, the pro-life legislators, they want to see this law pass. They want to push back. And that's what's happening in some of these states like Alabama. But by striking down the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, the Senate said no. The Democrats said no, we're going to push back. These infants, they should be treated as dead babies. Even if they come out alive, they should be treated as dead babies. That's what the leaders of the United States, a majority, have determined. You think about the first right guaranteed by the Declaration of Independence, the right to life. Life! What would the founders of the United States of America think? Well, leave aside abortion for a moment. What would the founders think of legislators striking down the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act? Here again from the Heritage Foundation, it says, in the mid-1990s through the early 2000s, more than two dozen states and the United States Congress passed legislation banning partial birth abortion, or PBA. It's a gruesome procedure in which a living baby is vaginally delivered until it is partially outside the mother's body and then killed, typically by puncturing the skull and removing the brains. In 2000, the Supreme Court struck down a Nebraska ban on partial birth abortion. The Supreme Court struck it down. This is 2000. This is the modern era. This is our modern, advanced, sophisticated era. It says the court considered the location of the infant's body at the moment of death during a partial birth abortion, delivered partially outside the body of the mother, to be of no legal significance under the precedents of Roe v. Wade, which created the right to abort unborn children. It says in a later Third Circuit Court of Appeals decision, that logic led the court to conclude that an infant's status under law, regardless of the child's location, was entirely dependent on whether or not the mother intended to have an abortion or give birth. It's her choice, right? That's what we're told. It says, in response to these rulings, Congress sought to provide protection for infants who are born alive. And that's what led up to, that's just a little history that led up to this Born Alive Protection Act. This is from the legislation itself, the legislation that was struck down. It says, the logical implications of Carhart and Farmer, that must be another case, are both obvious and disturbing. Under the logic of these decisions, once a child is marked for abortion, it is wholly irrelevant whether that child emerges from the womb as a live baby. That child may still be treated as though he or she did not exist and would not have any rights under the law, no rights to receive medical care, to be sustained in life, or to receive any care at all. It says, and if a child who survives an abortion and is born alive would have no claim to the protections of the law, there would then be no basis upon which the government may prohibit the abortionist from completely delivering an infant before killing it or allowing it to die. The right to abortion under this logic means nothing less than the right to a dead baby, no matter where the killing takes place. They're just trying to stop the progression here, the insanity. It's leading to infanticide. And it was struck down. Jill Stanek, she's a nurse who became a pro-life advocate after encountering one of these unwanted infants that was left to die. She testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee back in May of 2013. And here's what she had to say, clip two.
When I testified before this committee in 2000 and 2001, it was to tell of my experience as a registered nurse in the labor and delivery department at Christ Hospital in Oaklawn, Illinois, where I discovered babies were being aborted alive and shelved to die in the hospital's soiled utility room. Among other familiar faces that I see here today is Congressman Nadler, who was a member of the committee at that time, as he indicated earlier, and he said that he was appalled by the incidents I described and found them heart-wrenching. Indeed, I was traumatized and changed forever by my experience of holding a little abortion survivor for 45 minutes until he died, a 21 to 22-week-old baby who had been aborted because he had Down syndrome. Since then, other appalling stories of abortion survivors either being abandoned or outright killed have been trickling out.
Jill Stanek from her testimony back in 2013, and she went on to, she mentions these other chilling stories or appalling stories. Kermit Gosnell, we heard about him a few years ago, all these late-term abortions that he was performing. Douglas Carpin, another case. And she pointed out in her testimony that infants who are wanted by their mothers, well, they're given all of this medical care as soon as they're born, if there's any kind of difficulties or complications. But there's no such protection given to babies of the same age who are being aborted. The mother doesn't want the baby. They're not given care. They're not protected. Here's a little bit more from Ms. Stanek's testimony in 2013, clip 3.
It must be that some people inexplicably think that the abortion provides a firewall against fetal pain, or that babies marked for abortion are somehow numb, while their wanted counterparts aren't. This thinking is better suited for the Middle Ages than for modern medicine.
Right. We've had all these advancements in technology. You can see why those, Planned Parenthood and other outfits like that, you can see why they don't want young people to see an ultrasound, to see the life, to listen to the heartbeat. All of these advancements that we've had in science, showing that a fetus can feel, it can feel pain early on in the pregnancy. And yet we just want to turn a blind eye to it or erase it or say, well, it doesn't really happen, or, well, there really aren't cases where babies survive an abortion. As you probably know, there's many different types of abortion, dilation and aspiration abortions. That's usually in the first trimester when a solution of some kind is used to remove the fetus from the woman's uterus. There's suction techniques together with instruments, spoon-shaped instruments to forcibly remove the fetus. Dilation and evacuation abortions, those that are typically performed in the second trimester. This involves suction devices, instruments like forceps, again, to remove the fetus. And in most of these kinds of abortions, the fetus or the amniotic fluid is injected with a medicine to stop the fetal heartbeat. You could call it a medicine. It's more like a poison that ensures that the baby is dead before the procedure begins. But as I say, it doesn't always work. And then, of course, there are the cases where the fetus is dismembered, where I won't get into too many details. It's sickening. It's disgusting. It's barbaric. One abortion survivor, Melissa Oden, she testified before Congress about how that she was born alive during a botched saline abortion. That, again, is the substance injected in to kill the baby before it's then sucked out. She testified saying that, look, if the issue here is about women's rights, what about all of these little girls who are born? What about all of these little girls who survive abortion? What about all of these little girls in the womb? Here's some from Melissa's testimony back in 2000. This is just a few weeks ago, clip 4.
I'm here today to give a face and a voice to women whose rights are not just being threatened, but have been under attack for the past 46 years in our country and are clearly being even more heavily threatened as abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy with no restriction are being introduced and celebrated in states like New York, Illinois, and now Nevada. Today, you've heard countless stories already about how abortion is a difficult yet necessary decision, how every woman has a fundamental right to abortion. Every story is important. Every experience deserves to be heard. However, when we hear the stories about abortion, this narrative is woefully one-sided. Our culture has been inundated with messaging in which abortion controls the narrative. Yet largely ignored in this abortion narrative that is woven so skillfully throughout our culture, behind even the words in the title of this hearing, Reproductive Rights, are stories buried beneath the narrative of abortion that has been sown since Roe versus Wade. Is there space for stories like mine, women who are alive today after surviving failed abortion procedures? For stories like my biological mother's who have been coerced or forced into an abortion? Do we ever create space for the stories of women who regret their abortions? The most important stories, though, are those that you will likely never hear. The stories of the little girls who will never live outside of the womb. In all of this discussion about women's rights, some lose sight of the fact that without the right to life, there are no other rights. This is the greatest human rights issue we're facing as a country.
Without the right to life, there are no other rights, she says. And what about all the other stories that are never told? Young people, a young couple, or a young mother, coerced, forced into an abortion. And how many tens of thousands, perhaps millions, regret those abortions? Why aren't those stories told? Why isn't this woman's story told? Why do you see the popular culture, the left-wing media, Democrats in Washington? Why do they all gang up on Alabama as if Alabama's the problem? So one-sided. She went on to testify in that same hearing, clip 5.
And I'm here to tell you that in August of 1977, that's when the attack on my human rights began. My biological mother, as a 19-year-old college student, had a saline infusion abortion forced upon her by her own mother, a prominent nurse in their community, with the help of her friend and colleague, the local abortionist, Dr. Kelberg. That abortion procedure involved injecting a toxic salt solution into the amniotic fluid surrounding me in the womb. It was meant to poison and scald me to death. I soaked in that toxic salt solution over a 5-day period as they tried time and time again to induce my birth mother's labor with me. When I was finally expelled from the womb on that 5th day of the abortion procedure, my arrival into this world was not so much as a birth, but an accident, a live birth after a saline infusion abortion. My medical records actually state a saline infusion for an abortion was done, but was unsuccessful.
It was unsuccessful. Imagine using that term when describing an abortion. Unsuccessful. As if an abortion is a success. Now, the media, they would like for you to believe that this woman doesn't exist. That survivors of abortion don't exist. This is from Quartz Magazine. February, earlier this year, speaking about that Born Alive legislation. It says, the bill peddles the false narrative that abortions happening later in pregnancies could result in live babies left to die by physicians who fail to provide care that would otherwise keep them alive and healthy. This is not a practice that exists. yet the bill seeks to criminalize it. This is someone saying, look, this doesn't even happen. Doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as an abortion survivor. She goes on to write, the measure is misleading in other ways. An abortion performed with the intention of ending a pregnancy. An abortion is performed, rather, with the intention of ending a pregnancy. So there are no survivors. You see where this thinking is leading. If there's complications with the abortion procedure, and then the baby comes out alive? No, it's performed with the intent of ending a pregnancy. So there's no such thing as a survivor. So you can't give it medical attention. Just a little bit more here from Melissa's testimony earlier this year, clip 6.
It's easy to talk about women's reproductive rights until you recognize that without first the right to life, there are no other rights. How do you reconcile my rights as a woman who survived a failed abortion with what's being discussed here today? The abortion industry talks in abstract and gray when it comes to the science of when life begins and what abortion does, but the reality is much clearer. I'm alive today because someone else's reproductive right failed to end my life, as are the 287 abortion survivors I've connected with through my work in the Abortion Survivors Network. 184 of them are female. There's something wrong when someone's right results in another person's death. There's something deeply disturbing about the reality in our world that I have a right to an abortion, but I had never the simple right to live.
This woman could now legally abort a child. She has that right. But as she brought out there at the end of her statement, she was supposed to die. She has the right to an abortion now, according to U.S. law. But according to the same law, this is how twisted and contorted it has to be. According to the same law, she should have never existed. That pregnancy should have been terminated. She should have been killed. By today's standards, she should have been killed after the fact. After she survived the abortion. Certainly that's the thinking in some of these states like New York and Illinois. Where is this leading the United States of America? Just to, again, make another point here in passing. So deep the division. People finally pushing back against this 46 years of 50 or 60 abortions in the United States. The barbaric activities of the past 46 years. And maybe some states like Alabama now see hope with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and the Trump administration. Maybe they now see hope. But look at the so-called jokes aimed at, I think Mr. Hilliker brings this out in a piece from back in May. This guy writing at the Daily Wire just pointing out some facts about abortion. And of course, he's attacked on social media. People saying things like his mother should have aborted him. Look at what they say about Alabama and other such states. Another interview. This is Claire Colwell. She's speaking on a show called Focus on the Family. Here's her testimony, clip 7.
I think for me it has been shocking because to acknowledge that babies survive abortions and to acknowledge that we exist, they would have to go against everything that they have championed for so long. And so instead of acknowledging the truth, they are ignoring our existence. And so it has been shocking and even offensive to me as a woman, because this bill that would protect babies that survive abortions like us is being going under the same envelope as a woman's right to choose, when actually we are women that have survived abortions and our choice and our voice is not being heard. And so it's really telling where our country is right now.
These are the stories you just don't hear. Her story is not told. Her voice is not heard. On that same show, here again is Melissa Oden, also on Focus on the Family, clip 8.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable truth, isn't it? I mean, I was literally standing outside of the Senate when it failed to pass back in, what was that, February? I feel like these have been the longest few months ever, right? But I was there. I had my medical records in my hand, Jim, ready to share with even those Democrats who don't want to acknowledge us, who want to say, you know, babies like this don't exist. This is not a problem.
Never happens.
Right. It never happens. We have abortionists on Twitter still saying that, right? These things don't happen. Children aren't born alive. And there's, you know, a group of us saying, hi, look at us, hear us, see us. But instead, they simply fail to acknowledge that we exist because it goes against the narrative about abortion.
Right. They can't acknowledge you because you are real.
They can't acknowledge these survivors because it says a lot about life. Life in the womb, life at 24 weeks, 28 weeks, 30 weeks, 35, 40 weeks, life at 2 pounds, 5 pounds, 7 pounds. They just pretend they don't exist, as she said there. Fake news. It's not true. It's a myth. And here they are. As she said there, here we are. We're here. We have the records. There's a survivors of abortion network. Hundreds of people that have connected over the years. But all of these advocates for abortion rights, for women's rights. Well, these women you're seeing here today, if you're watching the stream or if you're hearing their voices, they do exist. Here's another one, Gianna Jessen. She, too, survived a failed saline abortion. She was speaking down in Victoria, Australia in 2008, clip 9.
I'm adopted, and my biological mother was 17, and so was my biological father. She was 7.5 months pregnant when she decided to go to Planned Parenthood, which is the largest abortion provider in the world, and they counseled her to have a late-term saline abortion, which is a saline salt solution that is injected into the mother's womb. The baby gulps that solution, it burns the baby inside and out, and then she is to deliver a dead baby within 24 hours, and to everyone's great shock and surprise, I didn't arrive dead but alive on April the 6th, 1977 in a Los Angeles County abortion clinic. What's fantastic about this, about the perfect timing of my arrival, is that the abortionist was not on duty yet. So he wasn't even given the opportunity to continue on with his plan for my life, which was death.
Another survivor. The abortionist, he wasn't on duty yet. And so she survived. Her mother, as you heard there, her mother was counseled by Planned Parenthood. Counseled to have a late-term saline abortion 7.5 months in. Here's a little more from Gianna, clip 10.
I should be blind, I should be burned, I should be dead, and yet I'm not. You know what is fantastic vindication is the fact that the abortionist had to sign my birth certificate. So I know who he is. And it also says, for any skeptic listening, on my medical records, born during saline abortion. Ha! They didn't win.
Well, they didn't win in her case, but in millions and millions and millions of other cases, they did win. They are winning. They continue to win, and they want to take it all, as you heard Governor Northam say, they want to take it all the way up to the time of the actual birth. Even after the birth, when the mother and the physicians can have a discussion about that life and possibly snuff it out. Fox News interviewed, again, some survivors of abortion earlier this year. Here's another case, Josiah Presley, clip 11.
Yeah, so I was adopted from South Korea into a family of 12 kids. And when I was 13, my adopted parents, they sat me down and they told me about how my birth mother actually had a curettage abortion when she was 2 months pregnant with me. And a curettage abortion is a type of abortion where the doctor goes into the mother's womb and basically rips the baby apart and brings them out in pieces. And that's actually why we think I'm probably missing an arm today. And so she had the procedure at 2 months, and then at 5 months realized that I was still alive, that the abortion failed. And at that point, I was born later on October 7th, 1995, and I was placed with an adoption agency and lived in a foster home for about a year before I came over to the States to live with the family I've grown up with.
You look at that young man on the video, and he looks to be very healthy, except that he's missing an arm. A reminder of what he survived not that long ago. Here's one final case from that same show, clip 12.
So my birth mother was 13 years old when she found out she was pregnant with me. She was in eighth grade, and her mother said that she wasn't ready to be a mother, and so she took her to a local abortion clinic, and she had a DNC surgical late-term abortion at 5 months along in her pregnancy, and they told her that her life would go back to normal, but a few weeks went by, and things weren't getting back to normal, and she went back, and they told her that her abortion had been successful, but that she was still pregnant, and one of the twins that she didn't know she was pregnant with had survived. And so she actually sought out a second late-term abortion in Kansas, but they, because of the risk of infection, they weren't able to do that, and so I was born 6 weeks later.
Her twin was aborted, and they sought out an abortion for her, the woman you just heard there. But it was unsuccessful. That gal, by the way, was born with dislocated hips and club feet because of the abortion or the attempted abortion. Now, pro-choice lawmakers, they often say that, well, abortions must be legal because of cases of rape or incest. Or maybe the mother's health is at risk. And then when pro-life lawmakers bring up abortion survivors, they say, as you heard today, some say, well, they don't even exist. Or if they do admit they exist, they say, well, it's such a small percentage of cases. We can't base law on these small percentages. And yet that's exactly what Roe v. Wade does, doesn't it? How many cases are there with respect to rape, incest, or the mother's health being at risk? Well, here again, it's hard to get to the data because most states don't keep track of it. Florida is one of the few states that actually records a reason for every abortion. Florida had 70,000 abortions in 2018. Last year, one state, the great state of Florida, as President Trump said on Tuesday night, the great state of Florida performed 70,000 abortions in 1 year, one calendar year. And as far as the reasons for these abortions, it's 1% because of incest, 0.14% because of rape, 0.27% were because of the woman's life being endangered by the pregnancy, 1% because of serious fetal abnormality, 1.48% were because of her physical health being threatened by the pregnancy, 1.67% was because of her psychological health being threatened or impacted by the pregnancy. 20% were for social or economic reasons. Can't afford it. So abort it. And 75% were labeled as no reason at all. Just did not want the baby. 75%. It's inconvenient for the mother. You add the 75% together with the 20%. Social and economic reasons. And then no reason at all. That's 95% of all the abortions in the state of Florida. They happened because it was inconvenient for the mother or for the parents, for the family. It's the tiniest, tiniest, tiniest percentage. If you want to talk about rape, incest, or the health of the mother. And here they establish law to allow for tens of millions of abortions. And the law's champions, they're out there saying, well, we have to do it, don't you know? We just have to. Because of this and this. In 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul says that in the last times, the last days, perilous times will come upon us, dangerous times, tens of millions of murders happening every year, an estimated 60 million since Roe v. Wade in 1973, right here in the United States of America. And what does your Bible say? It says in verse 2 of 2 Timothy 3, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. This is our society today, lovers of our own selves. And then verse 3, it says, without natural affection. Without natural affection. This is how it's prophesied to be. This is how degenerate we would become, God says. We wouldn't even have a natural affection. The natural, what you would think is the natural impulse. Never mind the procedure. Here is a life, whether it's at 28 weeks or 30 weeks or 32 weeks, here is a life that survived that procedure. So we want to drop everything and extend that life and protect that life. It's the first human right that's listed on the Declaration of Independence. Without that right, what other right is there? As you've heard some of them testify today. What does it say about our society? Are we really advancing? Are we really progressing? Without even natural affection, the natural affection or love that you would expect there to be coming from a mother and a father toward their children, whether born or unborn. It's easy to just become desensitized to all of this. It's been going on, after all, for 46 years. Mr. Hilliker, in that piece from May 29th, about abortion laws in America, a life and death battleground, he says even with his own life as a 46-year-old, he's lived on this earth. He's lived from Roe v. Wade to today. And just during his lifetime, and he's not an old man, he's a middle-aged man, just during his lifetime, 60 million people right here in the United States murdered. In Mystery of the Ages, this comes from chapter 3, Herbert Armstrong says, when man receives the Holy Spirit of God, the very spirit and mind of the immortal God is injected into him. It joins with his human spirit. This is all covered in Romans 8. God's spirit combining with our human spirit. It says the spirit of God cannot be received by or injected into the brute animal because the animal has no spirit within itself with which the spirit of God could combine. And now listen to this. He says, at this point, let me inject a truth that at the time this is being written is probably the most controversial question at issue among the Western world's population. The question of abortion. He says the human spirit enters the human embryo at conception. It is this spirit that may, upon adult conversion, be united with the Holy Spirit from the great Creator God, impregnating that human with God life as a child of the living God in a state of gestation, though as yet unborn. He says, to destroy an embryo or a fetus in a mother's uterus is to murder a potential future God being. Therefore, he writes, abortion is murder. You see, it goes far beyond just snuffing out the life of a mother's child. This is a potential future God being we're talking about. This is a life made in the image and likeness of God. Another quote in chapter 6. This is in Mystery of the Ages. He says again, we are already, though yet unborn, the begotten children of God. By direct comparison, the impregnated embryo or fetus in a mother-to-be's womb is already the child of its parents, though not yet born. Therefore, I remark in passing, abortion is murder. Of course it is. Of course it is. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here from our headquarters studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.